This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
How often does something on social media stir you up, get you raging? Once a week? Maybe daily? What is with that? Why is everyone so angry online? And has social media outrage just ruined everything? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're talking angertainment. What it is, why you're probably falling victim to it now. Also coming up, the reaction to Senator Pauline Hanson's address to National Press Club yesterday. She wants to end multiculturalism. So we're going to speak with Australia's Multicultural Affairs Minister.
Pauline Hanson yesterday, you know, wanted to talk about everything that she wanted to take away. She didn't talk about anything that she wants to give.
Yeah, that chat with Anne Ali coming up very soon. I'm keen to hear your thoughts as well. First, though,
Hack.
The presidents of the United States and Iran have signed a hard copy of the peace deal that will see the Strait of Hormuz reopened.
On Triple J.
Yeah, so that's it. The deal's been signed. It's now in force a day early. Many are hoping this could be the end of the Iran war. So what's in this agreement that the United States and Iran have made? And how are Iranians feeling about this? Shannon Schubert's got the latest.
And we wake up and, like, we read this news and, like, having a loved one with IRGC, sometimes we can't really share it in our words, in our actions, but it's very frustrating. We're very upset.
24-year-old Iranian-Australian Nico Jalavand Fard didn't rejoice when she heard that Iran and the US have signed a peace deal. Instead, she's thinking about her mother, who's in an Iranian prison under the regime of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and her friend, who was killed in the war.
They're still having the power. They're still putting people in prison. They're still cutting off the internet. People have been killed.
She says the signing of a peace deal won't change what it's like for those living in fear in Iran under an oppressive regime.
The presidents of the United States and Iran have officially signed a memorandum of understanding aimed at ending the war and reopening the Strait of Hormuz.
Both countries have now signed a memorandum of understanding, a day ahead of a meeting in Switzerland where they were expected to sign the agreement. Signing it signals their intentions to end the war.
I'm the boss.
But it's not as straightforward as saying the war is now over. The memorandum includes a commitment from the US and Iran to negotiate a final deal within 60 days. But that 60-day deadline could be extended again with mutual consent. In the meantime, the Strait of Hormuz is set to reopen toll-free on Friday. Well, toll-free for now anyway. Here's Iran's top negotiator, Mohammad Bakar Khalibaf.
During the war, I wrote in a tweet that the Strait of Hormuz would never go back to the way it was before, and I still hold that view today. That does not mean, however, that we intend to disregard international law.
So what's actually in this Memorandum of Understanding document? Well, there are 14 points. As well as a permanent ceasefire, it includes the US terminating all sanctions on Iran and unfreezing assets, a requirement that the US and its allies provide a $300 billion reconstruction plan for Iran, and the reassurance that Iran will not procure or develop nuclear weapons. Former US Assistant Secretary of State David Shenker says Tehran will be happy with the deal.
The agreement looks pretty heavily in favor of Iran. It succeeds in the main goal of opening the straits, but it has a lot of reward. I think all told, Iran's very happy with this agreement.
Under point 13 of the memorandum, both countries have agreed to action 5 of the points, while the details of the others are worked out. But there has been some disagreement between the leaders as to what exactly has been agreed to, including whether Israel will withdraw its occupation of Lebanon. So, will the ceasefire last? Is the war really over? Well, as the details of the deal started to come out, President Trump had already cast some doubt.
If I don't like it, we'll go back to shooting at them, dropping bombs on their head.
And there is still the official ceremony in Switzerland tomorrow between representatives for the US and Iran. President Trump won't be there, leaving US Vice President J.D. Vance to finalise the deal.
If it doesn't work out, I'm blaming J.D. You better be careful, J.D.
It's also worth keeping in mind that Israel, Lebanon, and Hezbollah are not parties to this deal. And there are still plenty of questions unanswered and key issues unsolved.
The key thing that has to be done with any nuclear deal is you have to get the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, back in Iran, back doing intrusive inspections and verifications, so we have a far better idea of what Iran's nuclear program is doing and not doing.
Alan Eyre was also a senior member of President Obama's negotiating team for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which Trump scrapped in 2018. He isn't convinced Iran will stop developing nuclear weapons and get rid of their stockpile.
We have brought into power in Iran a leadership that is more anti-US, more militarized, more hardline, more likely that this new Iranian regime will actually seek nuclear weapons.
Hack on Triple J.
Shannon Schubert reporting there, and we'll try to keep you across any major developments in that story.
Hack.
We cannot be a multicultural society. We are a multiracial society, but we must be monocultural.
On Triple J.
Yes, some are calling it a shameful display of hatred, but then there are others who see it very differently, saying they back her all the way. Senator Pauline Hanson's address to the National Press Club yesterday has continued to dominate the news. And as we discussed yesterday, one of the big moments in that speech was when Senator Hanson called for a monoculture in Australia, saying multiculturalism needs to be scrapped. And as you can imagine, there's been a strong reaction to those comments. So let's unpack them a little more now with someone from the government. Anne Ali is the Minister for Multicultural Affairs and is with us now. Minister, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure, Dave.
Senator Pauline Hanson says multiculturalism has failed and she wants it to end. Mm. You're the Minister for Multicultural Affairs. What's your response?
I guess my response is that what we heard yesterday from Senator Hanson was a whole bunch of grievances, a whole list of grievances, no solutions, but importantly, no positivity about Australia and no acknowledgement of who we are as a nation. Our nation is built on diversity. It's etched in our landscape and it's etched in our history. Our First Nations people, they spoke different languages, they practiced different cultural traditions. And I think that, you know, when she uses that kind of language and when she says those kinds of things, it absolutely seeks to completely disregard and destroy the diversity of Australia.
Does the idea of a monoculture concern you?
Well, I don't know what a monoculture is, and I don't know who gets to define this monoculture. I'll give you an example here, Dave. My family, we came from Egypt, right? In my extended family now, there are people who hail from Egypt, Canada, Bosnia, Somalia, Mauritius, Ireland, Burma, First Nations, Dutch. That is in one family. That is just a microcosm. And one of the things that all this diversity brings with it is different practices, different cultures, different celebrations, different kinds of food. But it also brings with it a richness that improves our lives. It improves our economy. It benefits our economy. It benefits our lives socially in terms of governance, in terms of the decisions that are made.
I mean, obviously, Senator Hanson has a lot of support, though, and some of that support is coming from culturally diverse communities as well. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I had a conversation this morning, a roundtable with community leaders from different culturally diverse communities. And one of the things we talked about was how this kind of language also attempts to pit us against each other by using this kind of good migrant, bad migrant vibe, you know, like, oh, you're the good one because you do this and you're the bad one because you do that. And it seeks to pit us against each other. There is nothing good that comes out of this kind of language. And so I think the message to people like, you know, don't think she's not talking about you, bro. She's talking about you as well.
I mean, if we are in this situation, Minister, where politicians are successfully campaigning on a platform of ending multiculturalism, does that mean previous efforts around social cohesion have failed and the government hasn't done enough to address that?
No, I don't think so, Dave. And I'll tell you why. Because throughout Australia's history, we've seen this before. We have had episodes of this before. There have been a number of challenges in the history of this nation that really challenge this harmony that we have, this respect that we have for all people, regardless of where they come from. By and large, every single time, Australia has overcome. And I hold absolute optimism that that will be the case again.
So you're not concerned that this movement from One Nation really could prove successful, and we could see a Pauline Hanson government that starts to enact some of these plans?
Well, look, I don't take anything for granted. And of course, you know, we have to take everything seriously, but I have faith in the Australian people. I have a positive view. You know, Pauline Hanson yesterday, you know, wanted to talk about everything that she wanted to take away from Australians. She wants to take away multiculturalism. She wants to take away the SBS. She wants to take away the ABC. She wants to take away wage rises. She didn't talk about anything that she wants to give. I have faith in Australians. We are a decent group of people. Australian values are about fairness and equality.
Minister, onto another issue. On Monday, you and the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, met with four Australians who are part of that global Samud flotilla. They have accused the Israeli military of sexual assault and abuse, and now the Australian Federal Police is investigating. Do you believe them?
Oh, 100%.
Okay. And if you...
100%, no question.
Okay, no question that you'd believe the allegations.
Yep.
Why hasn't the government expelled the Israeli ambassador?
Well, that was one of the things that they put forward to us. I will say that in this meeting. Primarily, though, that meeting was about how do we start the process for them of accountability.
But if there's no question there, if there's no question there in your mind, shouldn't the Australian government be taking action?
We responded to their request around that specific. There were a number of requests. That was one of the specific ones. And we responded to that, and I think they understood our reasoning for that.
And what will accountability look like for you?
Look, I think people will have different opinions and different ideas of what accountability. I don't know that I can answer that yet, Dave, to be quite honest with you. I think that, like, I'm going to have a look and see what comes out of the investigation.
I mean, Israel's ambassador to Australia has said that this investigation is a waste of time. You're saying that you believe these allegations. What's your message then to Israel and its ambassador?
Well, I would say it's not a waste of time. Australians have made serious allegations. I believe them. And I would say it's not a waste of time.
Minister Anne Ali, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave.
And we have so many messages coming through, particularly on Senator Hanson's speech yesterday. We might try and pick this up on the Shake Up tomorrow. Love to hear your perspectives, your opinions then.
Hack. Have you ever scrolled on social media and been so enraged by a piece of content that you saw? That is called rage bait.
On Triple J.
How angry do you get on social media? Like, what really fires you up? And do you ever feel like you're being provoked, you're being stirred up? Are you a bit of a sucker for rage bait? And do you think the internet has become a much angrier place lately? Well, someone who has been looking into all of this is Ed Koper. Now, Ed is no stranger to social media, to politics. He's worked with the Labor Party, with the political movement GetUp as well, advising on communications, on strategy. And now he's decided to write a book on the currency of anger. It's called Angertainment, How Social Media Outrage Ruined Everything. And he's with us now. Ed Koper, welcome to Hack.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
I mean, rage bait, I guess, is nothing new. We've seen for decades talkback radio tabloids have really traded on provocative headlines and angles that will provoke people. What do you think has changed here?
Yeah, look, rage bait isn't new because our emotions aren't new. So part of this story is very ancient. What's new is that we now get the majority of our information from platforms that are excellent at mining those emotions and doing it in a really subconscious way. So anybody listening, don't feel bad if you've ever fallen for rage bait. It's a human reaction. It's an instinct that comes from your gut, and you can't avoid those triggers. The new thing is that the platform algorithms are all built around those triggers.
Why is it anger? Why aren't social media platforms, politicians, other people playing on some of our other nicer emotions like happiness or humour?
Yeah, and it can work with those. It actually works well for all emotions. So, you know, my feed over the weekend was full of the Socceroos victory and the Knicks victory and the NBA and these really positive emotions, very happy emotions. They did really well in the algorithm and they made me filled with warm fuzzies as well, and everyone had a great time. It's really hard to beat Turkey in a soccer match or to win the NBA World Championship, and it's really hard to generate those moments. That's why they're really rare. It's really easy to do the anger bit. So anger as an emotion is designed to be more powerful than our positive emotions. That's just evolution. We're triggered by anything that feels threatening.
How widespread is this style of content and angertainment, as you've termed it, where are we finding it?
We're finding it everywhere. And I think that people will know this from their own experience on social media. And you're starting to see less content from your friends and family and less content from pages that you actually follow. More and more of it is suggested. And it's not just about political rage bait. That's obviously something that we're seeing a lot of. Sometimes they're just cheap tricks to make us watch to the end of a video, like there's a secret reveal that's going to come that never happens, or maybe there's a deliberate typo.
I mean, I want to get into some examples because you give a heap in the book, and one is the furor over Sydney Sweeney's ad for American Eagle last year. People might remember the jeans ad. You say in the book, like all good angertainment, it was a manufactured provocation. Why do you say that?
Well, if you think about anyone who remembers that scandal, it came to their attention somehow. It was probably by someone giving some commentary on it. Certainly for me, I never saw the ad. I saw the reaction to the ad. And the reactions that I started seeing on social media were all about, everyone is outraged by this Sydney Sweeney ad. And this was a jeans campaign that said, Sydney Sweeney has great jeans, J-E-A-N-S. The outrage that everyone saw was that all of these people, the progressives, were angry that that was, you know, kind of racial coding for, you know, she's blonde, blue-eyed and white and G-E-N-E-S, yes, of course. Is she from the master race? You know, all of these kind of racial coding. And then everyone on the other side was saying, oh, you know, the left's war on hot women. You know, it's gone, wokeness has gone too far. And it just became this snowballing outrage that everyone was having an opinion on. But of course, if you forensically go through what happened, it reveals something else entirely. Nobody was actually outraged for about a week. It was only people saying, oh, this woke war on hot women, everyone's crying tears about this scandal. There was no scandal. They right. acted as if there was a scandal. And you know what? It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then people did become angry about it. So you've got to look at the motivations behind it and understand that in order to win attention on the internet, people are out there every day trying to make things culture war scandal.
So do you reckon there was a marketing team behind that who were really predicting how that would play out and wanting it to play out that way?
Look, I think American Eagle probably knew it was going to be controversial, and they knew that controversy sells. It gets attention. Negative attention is just as good as positive attention. But I don't think they would have even anticipated the scale of that. And what happens away from the actual brands trying to do that is there are these networks that are built to look for the outrage of the day. And they actually throw as much stuff against the wall as possible. 99% of it you don't see because it never takes off. But 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, whatever the ratio is, all of a sudden something takes off and they're built to respond to that, and all of a sudden they pile on.
So it can spill over from anger, which can be a very solo kind of emotion, to outrage.
Yeah, and we're built to do that. Anger is like a virus. It spreads from person to person, and collective anger becomes collective outrage. Now, normally that's a good thing in society, because if something happens that violates our moral code, we get angry together, we turn it into an outrage, and we express our opposition to it, and hopefully those in power listen and correct the wrong. That's the good form of it. Unfortunately, it maps onto the same effects on social media at a global scale, and all of a sudden we can't suppress those instinctual urges to get angry together.
It's all pretty exhausting, Ed, isn't it? When you think about how much we are potentially being manipulated here and our emotions are being played on. I mean, it's tiring.
We're not supposed to spend all of our time in that high and emotional state.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be out there tilling the field for, you know, most of the day, and then all of a sudden, you know, a lion or a tiger comes over the hill and we pick up our spear and respond to it. You're not supposed to be constantly holding your spear out, fighting off the lions or fighting off the saber-toothed tigers. But that's what we get on social media. We really get the effect that we're always under threat.
And people can really relate to this. Someone on the text line now saying, Ragebait has overtaken my partner's feed. I've had to have a serious talk about how much it's affecting both of our moods. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese, speaking with Ed Koper, who has written a book called Angertainment, How Social Media Outrage Ruined Everything. Ed, let's get into another example that you used in your book. Great Northern, the beer brand, launched a campaign, and then there was this whole lot of anger and controversy around it. What happened?
So Great Northern, what was their great sin? If you've seen their kind of marketing campaigns, it's all very outdoorsy camping. And so they had a promotion that you could support and they would give a donation to a national parks charity to buy up some land to preserve for national parks. There was one Facebook group called Four Wheel Drive TV, full of four-wheel drive enthusiasts, who saw this as a great threat to their ability to drive their four-wheel drives. And so they did what people often do. They took to the internet to be really angry. And this took off. People did the same kind of thing, pouring the Great Northern out. It became an enormous media scandal. And, of course, the brand backed out of the promotion. Now, again, there's something at play here that a lot of people didn't see, and that is not many people actually were outraged. And the problem with social media outrage is it always appears larger than it is and all proportion is lost. If you look over the, you know, the stats on that particular campaign, the boycott hashtag was only used very sparingly by a few people. But it all of a sudden started to win the algorithm. It started to appear at the top of the feed and it appeared like it was a widely held opinion. And then, of course, the mainstream media does go and pick it up as if everyone is outraged. So the headlines that you see are things like Australians are boycotting Great Northern. And that's what has a real effect. And, of course, they pulled out from the promotion and, you know, it sends this chilling message to any brand out there that anything they do might become an internet outrage when in actual fact, not that many people really cared.
That's so interesting. And I mean, we're also seeing that from politicians as well. Politicians have backed down from positions or, you know, views on things because of perceived outrage on the internet. Can you talk to us a bit more about how this is playing out in politics?
Well, it always, you know, for politics to work properly, decision makers have to be able to accurately gauge the level of outrage in the community. And this is the feature that's kind of thrown all of our democracy haywire, is that because social media preferences outrage over other things, the outrage is more likely to win, even if it doesn't represent public opinion. Now, the problem with that is there's all sorts of people have cottoned onto that. And so they know if they want to get their way politically, they just have to manufacture an outrage on social media and make it appear really big, and they will win. Now, there's one side of politics who's done this much more effectively than others, and that is generally the right, the far-right populists. These are the, you know, people like Trump and MAGA in the US, Pauline Hanson and One Nation in Australia, Nigel Farage and Reform in the UK. Now, it's not to say that that side of politics is the only one who can do this or is better suited. It's kind of agnostic. Anyone with any ideology, with any idea can do this. It's just that the first people to cotton on to how to do it and how to do it effectively have all come from that kind of populist wing of politics. And that's why we see them on the march so successfully at the moment.
Yeah, I want to talk about how anger and angertainment could be influencing politics here in Australia because, you know, this week, Senator Pauline Hanson addressing the National Press Club, One Nation also launching an ad campaign against Anthony Albanese that really hones in on this idea of him being a liar. How do you see One Nation employing some of these tactics in the months and years ahead heading up to the next election?
Well, it's a really useful experiment to think about because Pauline Hanson has actually been out there saying the same thing since the mid-1990s. Since then, her and her party really haven't got above 5% of the vote. And all of a sudden, all we're doing is talking about Pauline in 2026 and she's polling at somewhere around 25% of the vote. Now, what's changed? Two really big factors. The first is I think our grievances have got a lot worse and people feel like they're not doing very well at the moment. And that's the foundation that a lot of grievance politicians tap. But the other thing that's changed is we're getting our information on social media. So it has to be a factor that if you start getting your opinions from somewhere that favours fringe, extreme, emotional opinions, then of course people who peddle those are going to start getting heard. So that's what we've seen. And those two factors are really big in explaining why we're in this situation all of a sudden. Now, what are we going to see looking forward? Unless those who are competing against Pauline Hanson can also natively tap those grievances and speak the language in social media that we do, I think we're going to hear more and more from her. And a bit like, you know, the example of Great Northern where nobody was particularly outraged and all of a sudden everyone is because the mainstream media started talking about it, the same effect happens in politics. All of the headlines at the moment are, why is Pauline Hanson so popular? Why is she the preferred prime minister? And what's the effect? People hear that message incessantly. And I know this works because I lived in America in 2016 when this happened to Donald Trump. Donald Trump was a joke when he launched his campaign and nobody took him seriously, but the media obsessed about him endlessly. And guess what? After a year of hearing about him nonstop, he won the election. So what we give attention to is incredibly important, and people who can game the platforms with cheap attention tricks, they're going to win.
You're listening to Hark. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Ed Koper. He's written a book about outrage on social media, how it's used to grab your attention. And we've got a lot of messages coming through. Someone's saying, I've just quit social media for good because of rage bait. Ed, with all of the stuff that you've just talked about in mind in terms of politics and rage baiting, what can politicians do if they want to fight against this stuff or compete with it? Like, what would you advise politicians do?
There are a couple of really powerful antidotes. One of them is authenticity. And sometimes that's really uncomfortable for politicians. We're used to the polished press conference. I mean, think about the Teal movement who aren't kind of bound by the same restrictions. What do they have? They don't have anger, but they've done incredibly well. What is their brand? Authenticity. Would I want to have a beer with this person? And then the other thing they've got to do is acknowledge that these grievances are real. These anxieties are real that drive people to populist policies. You can't keep telling everyone how good they're doing. If you want to reassure them that they will be better off under you, I think you've got to start by acknowledging that and then go to the solutions. I think we go to the solutions way too quickly.
Ed, as someone who works in comms and strategy, have you ever employed some of these tactics yourself?
Don't get me wrong. I am telling you this from the trenches. I'm someone who tries to make people angry on the internet every day.
Oh, no.
I would say about, you know, very valid causes and reasons. But I get how it works. This is what I do for a living. And I'm telling you that something fundamental has changed. The playing field is not level. What's changed is people are not trusting information in the same way. There's so much AI slop out there that they shut off from good information and they either question everything or they take the bad information wholesale. I'm ringing the alarm bell that the way that we have these important debates in society, the way that we try to get attention on issues and make people outraged about things they should be outraged about, that's changed dramatically in the last few years and not in a good way.
Very sobering point you make in the book. You say social media has become a brutal machine that weaponizes our own cognition against us. This machine that covets our attention and mines our emotion is now the supreme vehicle for social control, political power, and cultural capital. Great. What do we do about it? What do we do, Ed?
Well, the first thing we can do is just acknowledge that. Well, you've got to understand that you are getting information on platforms that serve you rage bait. And so that makes you better able to spot it. If you're able to pause when you see something and say, well, hang on a minute, is this person just trying to make me angry? Buyer beware when you're on social media. And then you've got to support the people who are giving you quality information. Once you've determined how do I tell good from bad, if someone's out there giving quality information, keep listening to Triple J Hack. Go and pay for the Substack of your favourite creators and journalists out there on social media and, you know, acknowledge that this is really important for a society for us to have quality sources of information.
Do you see a way back? I mean, I think about, you know, the dead internet theory, stuff like that, where people say one day we'll just be swimming in all of this unverified slop and there might be a real journey back to considered debate.
I do think that's going to happen because why are we in this predicament? The big tech platforms make a lot of money when our engagement is kept on social media. So they, all these tricks are just about keeping us scrolling. Now, we're not going to keep scrolling the more that it is an experience of watching bots argue with other bots. We will switch off. And as soon as we do that, these platforms will have to change because they will have lost our attention. It's all about our attention. And I think just on an individual level, there's a much more of an understanding in society that there are social harms. And I think we're going to see a renaissance in people going out and touching the grass, having real conversations. And there's still a need, there's still a desire for people to be out there in real life. And I think we're going to see a resurgence.
Ah, time to go touch some grass. Nice to end things on a bit of a positive note. It's such an interesting read and I highly recommend it. It's not all doom and gloom. It's funny as well. And just, I don't know, just really enlightening and stuff that you might not think about on a daily basis, but it affects all of us. So it's called Angertainment, out now. Author Ed Koper, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Dave.
And if you do want to hear the full chat with Ed, it's up on the Hack Podcast now. Go take a listen. So much coming through on the text line about this. You've got big thoughts. Someone's saying, it sounds like this guy is outraged by people's outrages. Maybe. That's a pretty simple way of putting it, I guess. Another person saying, look, I see so much negativity in my friends and family that I think comes from social media. I don't have social media and I feel like I don't have that negative look on life. That's interesting. I actually know some friends that got rid of socials for a bit and definitely they reported that their moods got better. They started to see things a little differently. Another person saying, I hold back on social media for fear of it being interpreted through an outrage lens. Well-meaning, simple conversations can snowball into something negative. And another person saying, I hate rage bait. Wait. Is this rage bait? It could be. It could be. All right, that is all we've got time for on Hack for Now.